For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support comes from the Germantown Community Library in Germantown, reminding you that the current economic times have been tough on many families in the area. Many people are finding it hard to make ends meet. Your donations of clothing or canned goods can make a difference for a family in need. This reminder from the Germantown Community Library on Mequon Road, where they're always working to make our area a safer place to live, work, and raise a family. Call 262-253-7760.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we'll be looking at the intersecting lives of two great Americans around the turn of the century, writer Mark Twain and a public official by the name of John Hay, with ties to Carthage College. In part two, you're going to be meeting a very talented young poet. Here's part one of today's program. We're turning our attention backward to a really crucial time in American history. Some would say there's never been a more crucial decade when it came to the development of the United States into the kind of world power which it is today. We're talking about the decade of roughly 1895 to 1905, years which included the fighting of the Spanish-American War. And it was in many ways that it was during this period that the United States first strode proudly and confidently onto the world stage in a way that it had not before. And we are taken into that decade in a brand new book, which is actually, on the surface at least, more about two important men who lived during that crucial time in our country's history. One of them, a man by the name of John Hay. The other, of course, one of the best-known writers in history, Mark Twain. These were two men with kind of an interesting personal connection with one another, and a friendship, albeit a sometimes uneasy one, and a friendship that became especially uneasy in this eventful decade when John Hay, a Secretary of State under both President McKinley and President Theodore Roosevelt, helped to facilitate America's aggressive moves as an imperial power, much to the dismay of Mark Twain, who did not hesitate to express his misgivings. And the story of the interesting connection between these two Americans is told in this brilliant new book called The Statesman and the Storyteller: John Hay, Mark Twain, and the Rise of American Imperialism. The author of the book is Mark Zwanitzer, who not only is well known for a previous book called Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? The Carter Family and Their Legacy in American Music, but also well known as the producer of a number of different important documentary films, including most notably for American Experience, marvelous films about Joe DiMaggio, Jesse James, Walt Whitman, Mount Rushmore, the Transcontinental Railroad, among others. And I've had the pleasure of speaking with Mark Zwanitzer before, and I'm very, very excited to speak with him about his wonderful new book, The Statesman and the Storyteller. Mark Zwanitzer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's great to be back with you.
So happy to be talking with you. This is an interesting idea for a book. It's about several sort of different things kind of all at once. And it's interesting. I read probably 10 different reviews of the book. And although just about all of them are quite positive, almost every reviewer takes a moment to sort of express their almost dismay in certain cases that you attempted to write a book like this, that in a sense, from the very outset, is not a particularly neat or tidy premise. Can you just talk a moment about how challenging it was to tell a story that, right from the outset, is so complex?
Well, yeah, and I didn't set out to do a complex book. I really set out to do a book about the last 10 years of the life of John Hay and these extraordinary events on the national stage that he was so involved in. But his old pal, Mark Twain, kept popping up on the sidelines. And what I realized was that I would be able to tell the events of the day through two very different points of view, and for two men who were actually connected personally. And more than that, two men who at that point in time had really put their stake their reputations on what was happening. They, they were both more than 60 and were at an age when they could have stepped to the sidelines and lived out their lives in relative prosperity and quiet. But each man still wanted to have an effect on the world and was working very hard to do it. And there were great triumphs for each man in this time, and there were awful consequences and downsides to it as well. So it's a very human story. I think it's a way to tell this story of this period in American history, but through a much more personal lens.
I want to mention before I forget that listeners here in southeastern Wisconsin should have a particular interest in John Hay, because of a connection that he has with a liberal arts school right down the road from our studios, a school where I happen to teach music in my other life. And John Hay is a alum of Carthage College. Back when he attended, it was called something else down in the central part of Illinois, but it is one and the same school. And on our campus, there is a striking statue of Abraham Lincoln and a young man seated before him, listening to him tell a story, and that young man seated is John Hay, and that sculpture is called A Learning Moment, and one sees it as you drive onto the campus. So a lot of people here, without even realizing it, have at least seen a sculpture of this John Hay, who first gained notoriety, of course, as one of the personal secretaries of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, that sounds like a great metaphor for John Hay, because we all kind of like glancingly know about him, but people don't know a lot about him, and people should know more about him. He had a remarkable life. To be 22 years old and one of the two private secretaries to the President of the United States in the most momentous and frightening piece of American history. I mean, the country was literally collapsing, about to come to an end. And John Hay saw the burdens of the presidency on a single mortal man up close in a way that, other people just couldn't possibly see it. So, he brought that understanding into his work much later as both the ambassador in London and then the Secretary of State to McKinley and Roosevelt from 1898 to 1905, he recognized the burdens of the presidency, and he saw it as his job to relieve the president of those burdens and to be the best possible implementer and facilitator of policy as he could be. He was not a policy maker as much as he was a facilitator and implementer. And you know, there's a certain amount of humility to John Hay. He recognizes that, that the president is the elected official, and he's there to help him see to it that his it helps do the president's bidding.
Hmm. We all know, of course, that Mark Twain was a brilliant writer. Probably people don't realize the extent to which John Hay himself was also a brilliant writer. And in the prologue to the book, you make mention, first of all, of John Hay's Civil War diaries, and then the letters and diaries and official correspondence that date from this particular 10-year period, which your book focuses upon, the last 10 years of John Hay's life. Just talk for a moment about this treasure trove and what they yielded to you as you explored them.
Well, what was remarkable about both these men, but particularly about Hay, was that, you know, I spent many years reading day by day by day exactly what John Hay was writing in diaries, in letters, in official correspondence. And he was a spectacular writer, a spectacular observer, a man who understood human nature, a man who understood human beings and motivations. He was, you know, he was the sort of person who took a step back and was able to watch events unfold and in time and make sense of them. And you also got a feeling of how he felt about things moment by moment, day by day. You know, our emotions, our ideas are changing constantly, and that really comes through in these in everything that Hay wrote. It's a biographer's dream what he left behind.
One of the things that's so intriguing about Mark Twain and John Hay is that they share, at least to some extent, a common background, at least a common geographical background, but that in so many other ways, particularly when it came to personality, they were markedly different from each other. And of course, that doesn't mean that a friendship isn't possible or a mutual respect and admiration for one another. But it is a complicated relationship between the two men. Sketch the most important things we need to know about them as two men.
Sure. And I think one thing you can say, too, is that they actually admired the differences, you know, the way the other man was different. You know, and I think that the most telling thing was that John Hay was a man who really went with the current of the times. He did not try to stand up and push back what he called the cosmic tendency. He was also a very elegant man. You would never mark him as a man of the who grew up with the Mississippi River mud between his toes. Whereas Mark Twain was an opposite in many ways. He could be coarse. He could be he could be grating at times. He was a guy on the make, and he also was natural contrarian. He was always swimming upstream. I mean, and a case in point, he was living in Vienna when the Spanish-American War broke out, and everybody in Austria, they were pro-Spanish, which I think led Twain in the beginning to be much more pro-American about this adventure. He actually was thrilled with the idea that we were going to liberate the Cuban people from Spanish misrule. He said, I'd join the fight myself if it weren't for the danger. And it was only later, when things went a little bit sour after the war, that he really stood up and became a great dissenter in what was happening.
Hmm. Explain how the two of them met. I believe it was in the late 1860s, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and they were both sort of first making their own first fame. Hay was known as already as Lincoln's private secretary, and so he had been in the newspapers. People knew the name John Hay. He was also starting to write his own poetry, and he was a newspaper editor at the time. And Sam Clemens was a young man on the making his first fame with his Sandwich Island or Hawaiian lectures. And he was in New York a good bit, having fun with the New York editors and promoting himself. And they first got to know one another then, and I think knew and liked one another and recognized a very similar upbringing as well.
We're speaking with Mark Swanitzer about his book, The Statesman and the Storyteller, John Hay, Mark Twain, and the Rise of American Imperialism. Your book focuses on the decade 1895 to 1905. And by this point in time, John Hay and Mark Twain have each experienced quite a lot, and they find themselves in different ways, both in somewhat challenging circumstances. Let's begin with Mark Twain and the financial ruin that he finds himself in, which necessitates him embarking on an ambitious international performance tour. Talk first about why Mark Twain, or how Mark Twain found himself on the verge of bankruptcy.
Well, he had started a publishing company, Charles Webster, and they were actually quite successful in the beginning, but had a pretty significant downturn, and there was an enormous depression in 1893, so that didn't help matters. But he lost a good bit of money in the publishing company and had to declare bankruptcy. He also had poured money into a printing press that never really worked. So he was essentially what would be in our dollars today, a couple million dollars in debt. And though he worked out a bankruptcy scheme to pay it off at 50 cents on the dollar, his wife really insisted that as a matter of honor and to clear his good name, he paid off everybody to the dollar, which he did. And he his first effort was to literally go around the world on a speaking tour, which he embarked on in 1895, which is where I begin the book. It was extraordinarily difficult effort, and there were great losses for him along the way. It took him almost 3 years to get it paid off, but he did, and was sort of reached in laurels for having done that.
Explain the personal sorrows which Mark Twain either had already experienced or was about to experience.
Yeah, I mean, in this time period I'm dealing with, he lost his eldest daughter, he lost his wife, and his youngest daughter Jean was ravaged by epilepsy, which was always a problem in the family. So he was dealing with some pretty big personal things and personal losses all through this time period. I was remarkable to me how he kept putting one foot in front of the other.
John Hay has lived quite an eventful life by this point in time. One of the things you mention is that not only was he a great writer, but in terms of the stories that he had to share, whether they were written down or just sort of the conversations one has, that they often involved extraordinary people and extraordinary events of which he had been a firsthand witness. So, his life was an exceptionally interesting and eventful one. But what is the state of affairs by the time we reach 1895 for John Hay?
Well, you know, he had married well. He had married and basically made himself. He earned his fortune by marrying well. So he didn't have to work. He really could have sort of, as I said, lived out his life in peace and quiet. But in 1895, he really decided he wanted to be a part of American government again. And he did such a spectacular job as McKinley's ambassador in London. I mean, when we talk about the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain, I don't think there's any American who had more to do with solidifying that relationship than John Hay, which he did in 1897 and 98. And then he did such a good job that McKinley grabbed him to be Secretary of State. Now, Hay said at the time, you know, this job is going to kill me in 6 months. He really didn't think he was physically up to it. But he ended up being Secretary of State for seven of the most momentous years in American history. And you know, just kept, saw it as his duty, you know, to pick up his pack and just keep going. He had faced remarkable both personal setbacks and political setbacks, physical setbacks, illnesses. And he was remarkable in the way that he just didn't stop. 7 years, and for five of those years, people don't realize this because of the way the succession to the presidency worked. There was no vice president for five of those years because Hobart had died, McKinley's first vice president, and Roosevelt had moved up when McKinley was assassinated. So John Hay was actually second in line to the presidency for almost five of the 7 years he served as Secretary of State, which did not make his wife happy.
Right.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments in the book, in some ways, is inconsequential, but I think it gives our listeners a sense of the level of detail that you share with us, is when you describe John Hay first arriving back in America as the newly appointed Secretary of State, the first time he comes to the White House. And you describe what the White House was like at that point in time, not only the White House itself physically, but also who could sort of walk in and out of the White House with complete freedom. And, right. You know, it's just nothing like the hermetically sealed airtight structure that it is now. And you also mentioned in passing, but it's, I think, extraordinary that John Hay was greeted by someone who was working in the White House at the time that he was there with President Lincoln all those decades earlier. It's just a remarkable portrait.
Yeah, if you can imagine what it must... Well, first of all, Hay lived right across the Lafayette Park. His house literally looked out onto the White House, which was, you know, the people's house at that point in time. And folks really did mill around, waiting for the president to come down to shake their hand. When Hay walked through the front door, there were, the doorkeeper was a man named Pendle, who was the man who literally opened the door and saw Abraham Lincoln out in April 1865, the night he went to Ford's Theater and was assassinated. So, as I say, it must have been like, you know, walking back through a wrinkle in time for John Hay to re-enter the White House. I mean, when he walked to the top of the stairs onto the second floor, he was literally next door to the room he and his friend John Nicolay had shared in the White House as their bedroom for 5 years.
Well, as we said at the outset, this book is primarily about the way in which America, in its sense, reshapes itself and the sort of new role it begins to play on the world stage in these formative years. It is really, in a sense, America coming of age as a world power. And what's so interesting, but maybe tricky for us to understand, is the role that John Hay played in that. I think you've already said in this interview that John Hay was someone with remarkable humility for as important as he was. And it was not about him implementing his own vision for America and the world. He was there to carry out the policies of first President McKinley and then President Roosevelt. That being said, he was not just a passive vessel, but really was an important cog in this political machinery.
Yeah. Yep. And he had one deeply held belief, which was sort of his North Star, which is he was a Republican in the old world sense. He believed that the future of the world depended on governments run by free men, men of means, men of education, men of standing, men of property. That was the hope for the world. And the idea was that, you know, the United States could help push this sort of freedom and liberty out into the world. I mean, we went into this this adventure, I think, with the best of intentions and got tripped up along the way with some of our less becoming facets. And I think that where we really tripped up, and I think that John Hay was a part of this, was on the question of race. In the Philippines, for instance, the notion was, well, the Filipinos couldn't possibly govern themselves because they weren't, you know, they weren't white men, you know, imbued with Western civilization. Theodore Roosevelt literally said in the campaign of 1900 that, you know, it took Anglo-Saxons 30 generations to be able to be self-governing. Why should we expect the Filipinos to be able to do this?
You share a heartbreaking story of what amounts to a Filipino diplomat dispatched to the White House with the earnest hope of sharing a letter with John Hay, who he hoped would then hand it over to the president, in a sense pleading the case for the Filipinos to at least have a hand in the shaping of whatever government might be put in place. And what you describe is complete disdain, and this diplomat not even being granted so much as a face-to-face meeting with Mr. Hay. It's just it's sickening to think about a scenario like that.
Yeah, it's Agoncillo actually did get in to see the president, and the president sort of sloughed him off onto Hay. You present your letter to Hay, and Hay did a pretty good job of avoiding him. And that diplomat arrived in Washington basically on almost the same day Hay came back to take over as Secretary of State. And this is one of the few places where John Hay really really tripped up, and that was on the question, I think, largely of race.
So say a quick word about Mark Twain's mounting sense of dismay over the direction that his own country was taking, and to what extent he felt free to express what was a very lonely minority opinion at that point in time.
Yeah, he, as I said, he's a natural contrarian. And by the time he got back to the United States from having lived away for 9 years, he arrived in 1900, just before the presidential election of 1900, and things had really gone sour in the Philippines. We were essentially fighting a counterinsurgency against the Filipino independence fighters there, and right down to the waterboarding, what was called then water cure. It was quite an ugly war, and there were a lot more deaths than casualties, for instance, than the Filipino among the Filipino fighters, which tells you how ugly the fighting was. And Sam Clemens was horrified by what was going on. And while he was always careful in his lifetime not to take strong political stands, lest he alienate readers, this was the one of the big instances in his life where he could not hold his tongue. He understood there were going to be consequences for standing up and calling out McKinley, and basically he said called the American flag polluted at that point in time. But he felt honor bound to stand up and speak out with not always great consequences.
Well, we can read about all that and more in your fascinating book called The Statesman and the Storyteller, John Hay, Mark Twain, and the Rise of American Imperialism, published by Algonquin Books, and the author, Mark Swanitzer. Mark Swanitzer, it was great to reconnect with you, and congratulations on a terrific book.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me again, Greg. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking to a young and gifted poet, Jacob Hunt, who goes by the name Other Poet as a poet, and that is the author's name that adorns the cover of his new book, which is called Shift, which is described as a person's healing journey. And we're going to be talking with Jacob Hunt about this book and about the way in which he approaches the art of poetry and what is behind this particular book, which is distributed by Blurb, again titled Shift. Jacob Hunt, other poet, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. What an amazing welcome. I don't deserve such an amazing introduction. So thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. So I saw on your website a few intriguing words about how you began writing. And it sounds like it happened back in your very early teens. And your mother had something to do with you first taking pen in hand. Describe what was going on in your life at the time and why you began writing.
Yeah, my parents were going through a divorce, and there were quite a few circumstances that kept, like, we had a death in the family, we had just a few really big life events for a teenager to go through. And kind of during that, my mom saw how much I was struggling, and you can read it on my website too, but my mom was like, hey, writing helped me through the things that I've been through. Writing has helped me cope with things. So she bought me a notebook and a special pen, and she said, I think you should write what you're feeling. And so I started writing poetry, not very good poetry. I still have the notebook, and it's, you know, I go back to it sometimes to be like, oh, it's so cute. And then it's like, oh, it's very cringy. But she kind of enabled me to write and encouraged it. She is also a writer and kind of has always encouraged creativity in our house. And so she would read the poetry, encourage me all along the way. She's just always kind of, she was the beginning of this journey that I've been on with poetry and writing and creativity.
So until that moment, had you ever written poetry before or done any kind of writing that would have indicated that this would be a serious pursuit for you, or was this an utterly new undertaking for you?
There was a book when I was in elementary school. I read a book by two football players, Rondé and Tiki Barber, published a book about themselves when they were kids playing football. And I also played football. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. They wrote a book. And I remember going and sitting at the family computer and writing a book. And I was so proud of it. And I showed my mom, and she said, Jacob, this is the same words that they use in their book. You can't do that. And so I always was interested in it. I was always writing little stories and telling stories. And my mom had been writing around me, so I knew that she had a book, and that kind of wanted to follow in her footsteps. I kind of looked at her as that first creative inspiration, and then it kind of grew from there.
Interesting. Yeah, so you are a football playing poet, which is not the most common of combinations, but that's really intriguing.
It isn't. I also, you know, now I'm coaching football now. I'm no longer playing, but yeah, it is kind of a combination of two things that don't seem to go together. But I really think that a multidimensional pursuit of what interests you is the way to go. And so the football and the poetry are definitely, you know, they seem to be at odds, but I really don't feel like they are. I think I get to be creative in both ways, and in both areas I get to encourage people. And that's kind of the foot that I lead with. Kind of that Ted Lasso brand of positivity. I think that they do tend to go together for me, at least.
So how would you describe the growth and development of your poetry from those first efforts when you were 13, which you yourself describe as sort of cringeworthy, at least to some extent, versus the poetry that you are creating now. I mean, what's different between your poetry now versus your poetry then?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference is that in the past it was all about me, and it was centered on me and what I was going through. And now I write for others and what others are going through, while also adding elements of story of, you know, it's not just me with a pen talking about my parents' divorce. It's a journey of a character that I've written. And the method of storytelling happens to be, you know, rather than a novel, it happens to be poetry. So it's very narrative driven. But yeah, I would say that it's no longer in my mind about me and for me. I think it helps me. It helps me through what I'm going through and is definitely still a coping mechanism, but it's also with the hope that it can help someone else.
So how would you describe your poetry in terms of what makes it poetry? In the sense that I think for most people who don't know a lot about poetry, they think of poetry in fairly narrow terms as something that rhymes and with kind of a sense of symmetry and rhythm. That's what a poem is versus something else, which we call prose. And of course, a more correct understanding of poetry is that it by no means needs to be confined to kind of standard rhyming schemes and other things that we think of immediately as poetic. In what way do you see what you write as being poetry instead of prose?
Yeah, I think what makes this poetry is that it breaks a lot of the rules of poetry. And I think that as you review what poetry has been over the years, is that it's constantly breaking the rules. It's like painting. It's like film. I think every poet kind of comes at these rules and what makes this poetry as, you know, from a unique perspective and says, how can I break this rule? How can I shape this to be me? And so what makes this poetry is that it definitely does break the rules. I do feel like poetry has a heartbeat and breathes and has that rhythm. And my poetry is definitely inspired by music. I listen to music all the time. It's definitely rhythmic. So I would say that rhythm, that cadence is definitely what makes it poetry. I'm also very comfortable without at times saying, yeah, this is prose. It's a combination of each. I think it's very lyrical. It's very, I don't know. I think that poetry should push poetry. I think it should push that boundary of what poetry is, and I think that this does that. Hmm.
Your book is titled Shift, and it is in some respects a large book compared to what we might think of as a poetry mm-hmm. collection, and I think you describe it with the word epic. Describe to our listeners what is kind of the through line of these poems in your book called Shift?
Yeah, so I want to very carefully make this comparison. But in terms of, you know, the epic portion of it, what I mean is that it's poetry with one story being driven underneath it, similar to the Iliad and the Odyssey. This character, the central character of the story is the Rocket Man, and his journey is an odyssey of sorts, and it's definitely an homage to those great Greek works, and were, you know, there are pieces that have been very much inspired by it. So that's what I mean by an epic. I mean that it is very narrative driven. And you're right, it's not built the same way as many poetry books today. It's a full 8x11 book. The pages are full of text that moves throughout. The spacing of the book is very unique, and it's very much, you know, you flip through the pages and it looks like it's moving and shifting. And it's telling this central journey. And there's a lot of stories in it that I tell, but it is telling this one narrative that, you know, you can trace through the whole book.
Why was it so important to you to be creative with placement of word on the page? Or do you recall what gave you the idea to think about that very basic matter in a really not basic way?
Yeah, I think, you know, ever since, really, this book was the first time that I had played so much with spacing. And I think there's meaning in the space. There's in the white negative space that isn't the words, there's meaning there. And it gives an added depth to it. It also, you know, from a rhythmic, lyrical standpoint, it does lend a hand in some of those delays when I want the reader to read something a little bit later than just like a set stanza that's, you know, built one on top of the other. So the spacing is very intentional, and there's a lot of breath in it. I really intentionally wanted this book to come alive for the reader. And I think that the spacing lends a hand to that.
The poems are not titled. That is, we have what seem to be individual poems, but none of them have their own titles. Was there a particular reason why you refrained from giving any of your poems titles?
Yes. I really want every person, every individual, to approach these poems and be able to find their own meaning and assign their own titles. I think that by giving it a title, I'm assigning what it means to me. And there are some that I have, you know, personal titles for. But I want everybody to be able to find their own meaning and their own place in these pages. So they are, you know, individual poems. It's one poem per page, but they do bleed together and they go together as well. So they're very connected, and it was a bit confusing when I first wrote it and the first editions. My first readers, like we talked about my mom, she's one of the first person to read any of my work. And she was like, I don't know where this one ends and this begins. And so I did give them page numbers to help us refer to the specific poems, like, oh, number 62, because that got a little confusing in the editing process. But I want every person to really be able to approach this in a unique way.
How did you come up with the term the Rocket Man?
Well, I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't shout out Elton John. Rocket Man has always been one of my favorite songs since I was a kid. And then I just am obsessed with space. My stepdad is the director of astronomy at a museum in Dayton, Ohio. And it's just an incredible, incredible place. I'm obsessed with space. So this character, kind of having his head in the clouds, then became this character on a journey to space. And I think there's a lot to be said about, like, a character called Rocket Man. You know, it doesn't have a name, and there's no face you just see the mask, really. And so I think that's another opportunity for anybody to see themselves there. I think the Rocket Man's journey has been something that anybody can really relate to. I think we all have big dreams ahead of us and big obstacles ahead of us. And that journey of this Rocket Man, you know, maybe you aren't going to space, but you do have a significant journey ahead of you. And so I think that it being this faceless, nameless Rocket Man really lends to, you know, if there was a reflection from the page that you could see, I think the Rocket Man's face is reflected and it looks like us.
Hmm. And finally, what about the title of this book, Shift? Explain that.
Yeah. Shift is, I really wrestled with the title of this, but Shift kept coming back to me because things are always changing in our lives and in my life, and it feels like the ground underneath us is shifting quite often. And I think Shift has multiple places in the book. Shift is the name of a character in the book, kind of the antagonist character is named Shift. The poems themselves shift throughout the book. And I think that the word shift is kind of something that can be applied to the entire book and this entire journey, whether it's this Rocket Man's healing journey or my personal journey where things have always seemed to be shifting and changing. And I think that in terms of shift, it's everything. The whole book goes back to there's a character called Shift, and this whole journey of life is always shifting.
Hmm. The book is titled Shift, and it is written by Jacob Hunt, who bills himself as Other Poet. The book is distributed by Blurb, and it's available through Amazon. Are there other ways in which people can find the book?
Yes, you can buy the book directly on my website, otherpoet.com. It's cheaper on my website, so I would strongly encourage to head over to my website. You can get to know more about me, about the book, and everything on my website. That's otherpoet.com.
Jacob Hunt, who is the Other Poet, thanks for joining me today on The Morning Show, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you're going to be hearing from the writer and producer of the next American Experience documentary. And it's a fascinating film called Riveted, The History of Blue Jeans. It's a really interesting look at blue jeans. Where do they come from? Who created them and when? It's a little more complicated story than you might have heard. But then the film goes beyond that to explore when and by whom blue jeans have been worn through the course of American history. From all kinds of people in the Old West to hippies in the 1960s and bikers in the 1950s and hip hop artists in the 1980s. In some ways, we can trace our own country's cultural history by tracing the history of blue jeans. That's what's explored in this film, and we'll talk about that tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking with the author of a new book called Impact, which looks at meteorites and their role in world history. On Thursday, I'm very, very excited to speak with Dr. Leslie Walker, who is Dean of the School of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we'll be talking about the 10th anniversary of the RITA, the RITA Talent Pickin'